I'm Rena Strigel. Welcome to Ag Inspo, the podcast that focuses on innovation and creativity in agriculture. In my travels across the U.S., my mind is blown by the farmers, ranchers, and business owners who are contributing to the richness of the agricultural landscape. My hope is that by sharing their stories, you will be inspired to have the courage to break through and bring an idea you have to life. Joe, it's great to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to just talk to me a little bit about what you've got going on at Eagles Catch.
Yeah, well, happy to join you today, Rena, and talk a little bit about fish farming in the Midwest.
That's right. So this is like really unique. In fact, I had heard about you guys coming to the Midwest, you know, way back when you were getting started. And I thought, really? Now this is going to be interesting, because most of the time you think about fishing needs to come from large bodies of water, not from our relatively small laked Iowa. So talk to me just a little bit about how you decided to get into raising fish and just a little bit about your operation.
Yeah, so going back about 7 years ago, I decided that I wanted to get into aquaculture, and it sounded like a good idea, so throw myself at it. So a couple things that really perked my interest. Now, I studied economics in school at one point in time, and there's a couple things that really perked my interests as to this market and why I think Iowa and Iowa farmers and Midwestern farmers are uniquely positioned to really take on a new market and do it to a very high degree. So right now, the United States imports about 90% of all of our seafood. So where's it coming from? Over 70% of all the seafood consumption in the United States comes from one country. You guess what country that is?
I would have no idea.
It's China, actually. So the interesting fact is that part of the world between China and India, accounting for over a third of the world's population, and yet we're buying over two-thirds of our seafood from them.
Wow.
So they're buying more and more pork, more and more chicken, more and more beef, and other, because as that area of the world, their median income level is continuing to rise. They've got over a third of the world's population. The first thing that they're buying when they get more money in their pockets is better nutrition for their family, which includes animal protein. And so over the 10 to 20 year outlook, when we consider that, again, over 70% of what we eat in seafood is coming just from China, where is that going to come from in the future? If they're going to get to a point where they end up having to retain all of their own seafood because they have to feed their own people. Now, let's throw a couple more facts on there. Of that 90% that we import, again, United States only accounts for only 9% of its own seafood. So over 90% is imported. About 1.2% of that is inspected.
Wow.
And now that is not inspected by USDA, that's inspected by FDA, which they don't really do any other animal agriculture products. And so just due to lack of resources and or lack of attention, they're just not putting a lot of resources behind inspecting seafood. So I guess leave that up to you. How much do you trust seafood? It's not inspected and coming from China. I don't know. Everyone has a different answer. And so of that, there of what is inspected tends to not be very good, tends to not have a very high acceptance rate. In fact, quite a bit is thrown out because of what they do inspect. So I'm hearing all of this at 7 years ago, and it said that sounds like really big market opportunity. And so I really threw myself at aquaculture. Here's a couple other things. Right now in the Midwest, all of our seafood is coming from the coasts inward.
Right.
Why don't we change that logistic chain to come from the inside of the country and try to expand out where we've got equal logistic distribution across the country. So there's a lot of opportunities there because, frankly, as a child, I hated seafood. I don't know about most of the people that are listening, but I just hated it, and it did not taste good to me, and it was just mushy, and it didn't have really any flavor, and I just didn't like it. So, and we took a family vacation to Florida, where we have some relatives, and we had seafood, and I did not want seafood, because I knew how bad it tasted then, and how bad the texture was, and except the problem was, is I actually really liked it, what I had there, and so, you know, that tells me now, is it's because we're in such a landlocked part of the country. Where is our seafood coming from? Well, it's coming from around the world. It's being frozen and thawed and processed and moved across the entire country. I hadn't had fresh seafood my entire life. And so this was really, really, really good stuff. So this furthers my opinion that there's such a large opportunity, especially here in the Midwest, to grow what we're already doing and to fill this huge market opportunity while providing better nutrition for American families by engaging rural communities. So our farm here in Eagles Catch is really the accumulation of the last 7 years of my life, as well as a cumulative over 100 years collective of growing and selling tilapia, which is a white fin fish, and we sell across the country into a number of different markets. So this it's a really, really great product, tilapia, when it's raised in a good environment. So we have, of these tilapia, the flavor is very, very mild. So we call it kind of like the chicken breast to seafood from the standpoint is it really lends itself to however you want to cook it. In fact, if you had a chef if you had a chef right there and they prepared it 12 different ways, you would have swore you had 12 different kinds of fish.
Wow.
And so it really lends itself to however you want to cook it. And it doesn't have a very strong fishy smell or taste. Yeah. And so a lot of people really, really like it when it's raised in a good environment. So that is, it's an affordable product. And we really think there's a lot of opportunity to grow that here in the Midwest. And how cool would it be to have Iowa as the number one seafood producing state in the nation, or another state here in the Midwest?
That'd be awfully big shift, I would say.
Yes, it would be.
So talk a little bit about, you know, obviously you, from an economic standpoint, you could see that this was going to be an opportunity in the marketplace. I am still fascinated to hear, though, how you... like, what were you doing before you were doing this, and sort of what did it take to get this facility that you are now in kind of actualized in some way? Because, you know, for a lot of people, when they're thinking about doing something that nobody else has done before, there is a lot of resistance, a lot of people that say, oh, you can't do that. So tell us a little bit about the journey from coming from understanding the economics of it to actually getting into production.
Yeah, that is a big jump. And Rena, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something that a lot of people discount. It's just because if there's a good idea, and if you know that there's a way to do it, that is still a far cry from actually doing it. And that is something that's overlooked by a lot of people. And so when I first decided that I wanted to get into aquaculture, what I did is I was at that time I had been 22, 23 years old, and I have this little Buick, still have it today. I bought out of a hail sale, and so I'm driving this little Buick. I'd read about a couple people now this Buick looks like a golf ball. It's got so many big dents in it. There was a big hailstorm, and we bought it off the lot after the hailstorm in Eldora, Iowa, which had a pretty bad event there a number of years ago. And so I got this little Buick, and I'd read a newspaper article about a couple of folks that were talking about aquaculture. So I found them online, and I found a way to get a hold of them, and I emailed them, and I sat down with one of them, Ray Hansen, with Iowa State University. He's retired now, but he was with the Value Added Ag Extension Program. And he provided me a lot of good knowledge and at least a really good starting point. The folks at Iowa State University Extension Programs, they do just such an awesome and excellent job. A lot of amazing great professionals there. And so he told me to get a hold of another individual, and this person told me to get a hold of another person, and that person told me to get a hold of somebody else. And before you knew it, I was on my way in my little Buick, my golf ball looking Buick, to Auburn, Alabama, and I stayed in a little hotel in Opelika, Alabama, and I went into Auburn, where I spent some time with their extension program guy by the name of Jesse Chappell that showed me around, took me to several different farms, and they were very, very kind to me and helped me start kind of my path of at least understanding what it takes for a fish farm to be successful. And so I went back and worked on several of those farms, and I just said, hey, let me work there for free, and I will do all of your dirtiest and greasiest jobs that you have. And they said, yeah, okay, that's fine. Then we can relieve some of our folks for a couple of days. And I'm sleeping in a tent just outside of my little Hailden Buick. And in my air conditioning goes out in the Buick. It's the month of July in Alabama. I sweat quite a bit, Rena, that month, but we did get at least some idea some ideas about what it takes for a fish farm to be successful, and you know, some of the suppliers and some of the markets and you know, some of the places that you can buy inputs and some of the technology. And so from that, I came home and drove right back up to Iowa, where we built the business plan. And there's a couple other farmers that were in our area that were really kind of excited about the opportunity as well. However, they didn't want to go work on fish farms in Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas to at least have some idea what it takes for a fish farm to be successful. So we decided that we wanted to work together. And so we built a fish farm near Buckeye, Iowa. And so I'm pretty darn near glued almost every pipe in that farm together. And at that time, we kind of realized some of the things that might have been wrong with the farm that we could have done better. And we started getting an idea is like, hey, you know, there's some things we want to change with what we're doing. We think we can make this a lot, lot better. And we eventually sold that farm in 2016. And started Eagle's Catch kind of from the idea framework behind what it was going to take for a fish farm to be successful long term. Now, there are a lot of people that want to get into the fish farming business. And it looks like there's a lot of margin potential. It looks like there's a really great market and macroeconomic opportunity here. But a lot of farms have difficulty in getting into consistent and stable production. And we really said, okay, why is that? What can we do to help farmers be more successful day one? Because after about 3 years, if a farm makes it past the 3-year mark, they tend to be successful after that. So what can we do in those first 3 years to make them more successful right off the bat? And so we said one of the biggest challenges that these fish farms has is production risk. And how can you make it stupid proof? So that way farmers don't have to learn, you know, a whole new industry and a whole new, you know, technology and everything else, because it's very different from other areas of agriculture. But to be able to provide these kinds of opportunities for farmers, they've got to be able to make to get past those first 3 years. And now there's a saying, Rena, and it's, you know, you're not a true fish farmer until you've killed a million fish. We don't think that is the right. We think there's a way around that. We think that there's a better way of doing it that reduces the production risk and makes farmers more successful in getting over that hump. And it all comes back to production risk. And that's one of the things that Eagles Catch was formed to really combat some of those things, to help provide leadership to farms so that way they can ultimately be more successful in their own family farm operations, be able to bring home the next generation and do some of those other things. And it all comes from leadership and reducing the production risk to make sure that they are more successful starting day one and have a consistent supply of fish and a consistent market and a consistent form of leadership that they can plan on for years to come. Now, that's why we started Eagles Catch. But it all, for us, it, all that meant we had to start with our own fish farm that reached a certain critical mass. And then from there, we'll be able to help provide leadership to many other family farmers.
Yeah, I think that there's so much in that little segment that you just did in terms of, you know, being willing to go and do what's necessary to learn what you were stepping into before you stepped in. There's a lot of people that might have just gotten excited and said, well, you know, build the facility and we will be successful because ISU says that it's a good value add. So I think that there's a lot in that, that you were, you know, kind of willing to do the hard, yucky jobs to see what that industry was really all about, to know if you even really wanted to do it in the first place.
Yeah.
And as a result, you now know through kind of trial and error how to do this really well so that you can teach others. So talk a little bit about what you hope will be the future of Eagles Catch, because you keep talking about, well, now we can set up other people. Now that seems like something a little bit contrary to what people would think about in terms of competition, which is, I know there's a big market, we could be the sole producer, so let's just try to keep as many people out in order to be able to capitalize on the economics of this. And yet, from what it sounds like to me, you're setting yourself up to get a lot more people into the industry. So talk a little bit about where you're going from here.
Yeah. So for any one company to capture that much economic value in a reasonable amount of time. Now, reasonable is what I mean by that is, can we capture the market opportunity, but also secure the American people's food source in the amount of time that it's needed? Can one company do that? No. But if we're able to bring in other stakeholders and bring in education for everyone, maybe not people that's with Eagles Catch, but across the board, it's ultimately going to help make us more successful if everyone is successful. And here's why. There is an entire supply chain here that is not set up for the amount of fish that are needed. And if there's just one fish farming company out there that is, you know, producing fish on, you know, some sort of critical mass scale, again, we're a drop in the bucket in terms of the greater macroeconomic need. There needs to be a lot of players here that is going to be able to help take on this macroeconomic opportunity, but also help all of the supporting industries reach a point where they can help make our farm be more competitive. So what I mean by that, right now, fish processing plants, the big ones, they're in Boston, they're in LA, they're in Florida, they're on the coasts, they're not in the Midwest. Our one farm might not even be the amount, the critical mass needed to make a processing plant viable. You know, feed production. You know, right now we're shipping feed from, we've got a great partner in Cargill. They still have to ship it from Franklinton, Louisiana. You know, it's a really great feed product. But still a big chunk of what we're paying for in feed is just in the trucking. And if we can get more mines and bring that feed production here to the Midwest, where we've got all of the ingredients, and maybe it's Cargill that helps us do that. I think that would be a great opportunity. There's a number of other companies that see this as a really big opportunity. But if we're able to utilize Midwestern products to help supply and bring our costs down, only comes with when other fish farms are in the area. It also helps from a marketing standpoint. You know, when we're at a certain level where we can reach, you know, quite a few markets. But for us to be able to reach the marketplaces where we really need to be, we're still a drop in the bucket. And so, you know, in some of those cases, we're not almost even worth the time of some of those buyers that, are buying in much larger quantities. Mm-hmm. And so if we can work together to help tackle some of these large macroeconomic needs, fill out these types of purchase orders, which, by the way, in the last couple of weeks, we've gotten interest from people, in buying our product over 1,000% of what we're able to produce. And we're not trying that hard really trying to find those marketplaces. There's a ton of opportunity, but as long as you're able to produce the fish, is really what it comes down to. If you can produce the fish, you know, the world is your oyster. I've got a lot of puns, Reno, when it comes to seafood. So there's a ton of opportunity there. So if there's some way that we can provide some leadership, other people that want to become fish farmers, help them be successful, ultimately is going to make us more successful. And we don't see, you know, if someone built a fish farm a mile down the road, they're not competition to us. They're helping us. And we really need to work together, overcome some of these challenges that faces fish farms across America, because there's quite a few that are holding us back, and being protectionary of what we have going on ultimately can only lead to further detriment of this industry. There's still a ton of opportunity for anybody to be too protectionary.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about just what is it like in the day of a life of a fish farmer? Like, what is the life cycle of these fish, and, you know, how long does it take them to get from wherever you start them to wherever they're ready for consumption? Just talk about that a little bit, because I have never thought about raising fish. So it's something I know nothing about.
Yeah. So I think there is a lot of a big learning curve when it comes to feeding fish. And it's all kind of centered around optimization. And how can you provide the environment on a consistent basis to the fish, that way they can thrive. And so, you know, a couple big things that we worry about is our water quality. And so that's one of the things that we're watching constantly and trying to make sure we're providing the best environment for the fish. And so, you know, we're taking daily water tests of almost every tank in our farm. And we use that information to make decisions when it comes to feeding. And so our fish, when we first bring them into our facility to the day that we send them out of our facility, is anywhere from 7 to 9 months. And so we think over time, as new genetics develop, which in many people's opinions, we're about 30 years behind chickens. With that in mind, modern breeding practices that people use in other livestock have really only been used for fish farming within the last 10 years. And so there's a lot of low-hanging fruit from a genetic standpoint. So we're raising these fish anywhere from 7 to 9 months, depending on the marketplace, depending on, you know, how big we get them to. And so every day we're testing for water on our biggest fish, you know, any, and will feed anywhere from 5 to 8 times a day. And there's a lot of science behind, you know, how many times you feed, at what time of life, what percentage of their body weight, at what intervals that maximize their metabolism. And so, you know, all of those variables combined really help play into, you know, how those fish, you know, grow, and really how you maintain your your production technology makes a big difference of things like, you know, death loss and you know, productivity and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of science. And Rena, I was a math guy. I never really got into biology. I didn't do too well in bio 101 college, but I was really happy. Well, I've learned more science in the last couple of years than I thought I would ever need to know. But there is a lot of science to what we do. I'm really trying to optimize how we fish.
So talk a little bit about, you know, just sort of size, how many people work with you, and, you know, what are your hopes for your facility? Are you at capacity with your facility? Are you thinking to expand? Like, what do you hope for your group?
Yeah, so we are right now, we're still under our fully operational capacity. We're still working towards that. We had our first sales in 2019, and so we're still kind of growing into that. Their latest, you know, disease, global epidemic has slowed some of the things, items for us, as they have, you know, everyone else in the world. And so that's been a little bit of a challenge lately. But, you know, we're expecting that, you know, this year that we can be at full capacity, and then hopefully be looking at expansion or bringing in other stakeholders, such as other farmers or other, you know, investors or folks that want to be in part of the future of aquaculture here in the Midwest as well.
If I was a farm family looking to do a value add and was thinking, okay, well, we're not maybe too excited about chickens or pigs, but maybe we could do fish. What would be some of the things that you would encourage a farm family to sort of think through? Because there's infrastructure, certainly, but then just in terms of lifestyle, like what does, you know, having a fish operation as part of your family operation do in terms of time commitments? Mm-hmm. You know, how easy is it to train somebody how to take care of them if you want to take a vacation? So just talk a little bit about the, you know, just sort of the logistics of all of it if somebody was thinking about this.
Yeah, so it is, you know, there is a lot of information to learn when getting into this market. You know, one of the things we hope to do with Eagles Catch is be able to, you know, provide some leadership to any individual farmers that wants to get involved, and helping them make the right decisions and helping them, you know, make, you know, with production technology, records keeping, water quality, genetics, feed, and market. You know, we hope to provide some of that leadership. You know, someone that is looking at getting, you know, involved in immediately, you know, one of the couple of things that you're really going to have to consider: number one, market. There is a market for the fish. There is people that want to buy your fish. However, connecting those opportunities with real world purchases, there's still some work to be done there, and in making those opportunities come to materialize. And so, you know, is there a market there? What is your source of fish? What is your source of feed? And especially the thing that I really, really hit on is on the production technology side and reducing production risk. If you walk out of your facility, can it break? Everything in your farm that you buy and you implement will at some point break. Anything that moves will break, and it's a law of nature. And so you have to consider, what is my production risk? when any one of these components breaks, because I guarantee you it will break at some point. And so I would focus a lot of attention on production risk and the production technology. Don't take any individual technology supplier's word for it. Go talk to other farmers and see what they've done to either be successful or what works and what doesn't. Because there's a lot of people that'll sell you all sorts of equipment. And there's a lot of investment firms that have hired big engineer firms and PhDs and hire PhDs to run farms, and it just doesn't work. And so I think that when you give the keys to this type of market to Midwestern farmers, it won't take them very long before they're going to be one of the world's world class at it. And you can look at any one of our major commodities here in the Midwest and see, you know, really what our roadmap is to success and here in the Midwest and what we know that we can do.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to just a minute, just like go back to when you were examining whether this was an opportunity, because it still seems like a very large leap for me that you and your early 20s, you know, could go live in a tent with your hail damaged car and come back and, you know, put all of this in play. So talk a little bit just about, like, did you get some partnerships? Did you have, you know, was your family behind this? Like, talk a little bit about just how you pulled all of this together to get that first farm in operation.
Yeah. So, we had my family was behind it. Thank goodness for my mom and my dad, that they, were very, very supportive in putting some of their, you know, their resources up, because they believed in me and they believed in the opportunity. And so can't understate how integral they were to myself being involved, especially in the early 20s. Net worth of a 23-year-old is fresh out of college is not that great. And so how does one at that age, you know, come up with the resources to help, you know, do some of those things? And so I talked about there's four other family farming operations that decided that they wanted to do this together. In fact, the first family that I sat down with, they had also thought about it and said, you know, they knew it was an opportunity. We had a mutual friend that kind of connected us. We sat down at a coffee shop in Iowa Falls, Iowa, and we were kind of talking about the opportunities, and we just looked and said, well, hey, why don't we just work on this together? You know, this wasn't me going and pitching, you know, the business to sophisticated investors that, because honestly, I was 23 years old asking for a lot of money. If I was a sophisticated investor, I probably wouldn't have invested either. But these other family farming operation, family farms, that decided to come in and join forces to do this. The Plagey family, which was from the Clear Lake area, the Scartweet family, which is close to where I'm from. In fact, our families go back two or three generations. And then we had the Norman family from down by Washington. And we all worked together towards this, building a fish farm here in central Iowa. It probably wasn't a typical like investment startup that most people, you know, we all just work together. And I think that's one of the really strong opportunities when working with farmers is that, you know, this, you know, we're really here to work together and make this successful. And so that was really integral to us building that farm, eventually selling that farm and continuing to move forward.
Yeah. I think that's really cool. I think that's probably another testament to just the Midwest is that people are willing to work together. And it's not always about the money, like, let me drop my money and, you know, show me a profit. People do genuinely get interested in projects and being kind of hands-on. So I think that was probably a smart move, is to engage people in actually participating as opposed to just saying, I need your money and then I'll let you know at the end of the year how we did on a profit loss scenario.
Yeah.
So what has happened since then? Have you gotten to the point where you feel like you need a board of directors? Are you still operating in kind of a collective group of farmers that are working together? Talk about, you know, what has evolved, what have you evolved to since those early days?
Yeah, so when we sold the first fish farm, you know, we at that point we launched Eagle's Catch, which was a whole new company and was a whole new operation. And so we actually, of course, when we built our first fish farm, it was in 2013-14. It was kind of the golden age of farming. And so it was, a lot of people looking for ways to diversify and had a little, and a lot of farmers at that time had some change in their pockets because the grain markets were really good. The weather was really good and, you know, everyone was doing pretty well. When we launched Eagle's Catch in 2016, you know, we kind of came off that thinking, oh, this is going to be no problem. We'll come up with, you know, the money in no time. We're really good at this. And the farming economy had changed and we found out that, oh, maybe it's not as easy as we thought. And over 80% of our investors are within 100 miles of where we sit today. Over 90% of them are either farmers or maybe once removed from the farm. And so there's still a lot of, you know, local agriculturists that are involved in what we're doing today. And we've got great partnerships, everybody from our investors, but to just the folks that they pour our cement, you know, Stan Penning with Cyment, you know, they're just down the road here about 10 or 12 miles, high school with his son. They did a really, really outstanding job and they were very competitive with their cement work. Short circuit electric out of Radcliffe, Iowa, just down the road, 7 miles, did a lot of our electrical contracting. They were very competitive and they've been very professional and they've done a really, really excellent job, as well as, you know, the local cement company that supplied the cement. There's so many things that we've done that's not just farmers that, but have, you know, hand sackers that did a lot of the dirt work, for the fish farm, and again was very competitive and really happy to have their, you know, relationship. This was AgForce, which is a local company here that helps supply us with PVC and everything else. You know, the local co-op, the local hardware Hank, the Jewel Farm and Home, just down the road, 4 or 5 miles. And so more than just the family farms, but the entire community, the entire economy, has really been behind what we're doing. Also, I'm looking out the window here to my right and seeing the Ellsworth, Iowa water treatment plant. The city of Ellsworth has just been excellent at helping make sure that, you know, that we're successful. They've been really good. They've got a lot going on here in Ellsworth, and it's because they do a really good job. And a lot of companies recognize that this little town of 530 people, you know, is doing some good things. And so right here off of I-35. And so more than just the family farmers that are our investors, but also the entire community that have built around, you know, what we've, you know, what we're doing. We're up to 34 employees that are, I think all but maybe two or three of them are local. And, you know, those were just some expertise that we need to look outside of just the local community for. But we're really happy that we could be hiring locally as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. So in terms of that, I think a lot of people get nervous sometimes about getting people involved in their operations or about letting people get too close. How have you felt? Because this was kind of your baby, your idea. You put in the sweat, literally, in your tent. And now you've got just all of these people that are financially tied to you. They're, if I know Iowans, they are emotionally tied to your success. Talk a little bit about how that has made you feel in terms of it being your idea, but now maybe a lot of people feeling like they have got, can take some credit for that.
Oh, you know, I might have supplied the idea, but like I said earlier, in our translating an idea into a market opportunity, that's a really big jump. And I think you alluded to that early in the podcast. It takes more than one mid-20s individual to help make some of these things a reality. There is a lot of really good, very smart, and very well-resourced people that are helping make this a success. You know, this is not a lone effort. I could not do this alone. My partner, Paul Skartweed, my COO, who is with me on the first fish farm, and we decided to run this together. You know, his whole family's behind this. My family's behind it. So as many other families that really want to see this successful. So I think, you know, doing this alone just isn't a feasible thing. And I think if we're really going to make these market opportunities a reality, it's going to take more than just a couple people. It's going to take a lot of people that on all levels, everywhere from finance to the utilities. We've got a really great partnership with Midland Power Cooperatives and the Rural Energy Cooperatives. And, you know, it takes the city being involved. It takes investors being involved that have different expertise and that we can apply to this, because there's so much to learn here. And we're so early in a new industry that we want to involve people that have been successful in other areas of agriculture in making ag be here in the Midwest world class. I mean, if I was its own country, it'd be the number three hog producing country in the world, and number one in ethanol, number one in corn, number two in soybeans, number one in eggs, number one in pork. So there's people that are around that understand what it takes to be successful on a large scale. And we want to utilize their knowledge and their expertise on all levels, from both, you know, like I was saying, finance to, you know, to production technology. How do you de-risk? How do you remove moving parts out of your system? How do you, you know, handle feed? How do you make genetic selection decisions? How do you do all these things? And you start to realize it's going to take a lot of people. It's going to take a lot of people that, you know how to grow and how to take on some of these large macroeconomic opportunities more than any one person.
Yeah, I think that that's like one thing that I've noticed in working with entrepreneurs for pretty much my entire career, is that if you take that look that my idea might get stolen or somebody will run and take it to market, you run the risk of maybe never getting to market at all. And I think that that's incredibly, you had a long distance view of this project in terms of making this sort of a community ownership almost, where you're just involving people and making them feel a part of it, which is now, you know, I could only guess the amount of energy and support you get from people when you want to try something new or to expand or to take a little bit bigger risk as you go through this and get better and better at what you're doing.
Absolutely.
So, you know, what would be sort of your piece of advice for, you know, farmers or other people who are in ag who know they have to do some value addition? We've got a lot of people that want to go back to their family farms. They want to stay close to rural America in some way, but maybe we just can't quite see financially how we're going to do that. What would be some of, you know, just your piece of advice as an entrepreneur, as someone who's very value added driven, what would you say would be some things that you would, you know, coach or advise people to be looking for as they're trying to find their way back home or trying to figure out how to stay at home and still be a part of the farming world of Iowa and the Midwest?
Yeah, I know it's tough. And, you know, of course, every family farm is different, and every family farm has, you know, their own set of challenges and opportunities. And you know, there's a lot of folks that are thinking of much better things than I could think of when it comes to, you know, what they can do and what, you know, their competencies are, you know, and really look at what your competencies are and see if there's any way that you can capture value from what you're really good at. And, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, new opportunities in ag. fish farming. I know you had a conversation with a cricket farmer recently, and you know, there's some weird and new different things that all sorts of people can get involved with. And, you know, I think, and, you know, one of the challenges that we have too is being rural. When you're as far removed from major population centers as we are, and when I say major population centers, I'm talking about one of the top 20, 30 metropolitan areas in the country, you know, that limits some of the, I guess, smaller farming. What I mean by smaller lots, you know, when I took a trip to Washington, and they had farms that were 4 acres that were doing a lot with 4 acres. It's a lot harder for us to do that in Iowa, just by nature of where we live. And so, you know, a lot of folks here look more towards commoditized products. And so, you know, maybe there's some opportunities that people can look into in getting some of those smaller products. You know, for example, the farm I was on, they were growing dandelions for salads, and they were doing really well with it. They're growing like, I think, a quarter acre, and they grew a lot of product on a quarter acre. So there's all sorts of opportunities, and it thinks, you know, it's going to take some different thinking in terms of how do you bring that to market. I think that's one of the biggest challenges that farmers have, is getting those products to market, thinking beyond, you know, is there something more that I can do just in my immediate community? There's a lot of opportunities and you're in your immediate community, but can you reach larger metropolitan areas where there's bigger markets for localized foods for all sorts of different products? And so I don't really know how to answer the question best, Rena. And I think it really comes down to, what each and every person's either family farm or a local community, what kind of opportunities that.
Yeah. I think that, you know, that's one thing that I really became very aware when I was living and working overseas, is that those overseas markets are always thinking about how do we get products to the US, right? So they're always thinking globally, like from a very little itty bitty, every product they're trying to figure out how to get it to the US. And I think sometimes the US, we don't have quite that scope. We don't think globally like that. We don't usually think kind of beyond, you know, where we're going to take that product, whether it's the co-op or, and we just don't think about how to get to the consumers in the Midwest the way they do in other parts of the world. So I really liked how you started in terms of, you know, going and just starting it sounds like a very long series of conversations. So the extension, who sent you to a guy, who sent you to a guy, who sent you to a guy. So talk a little bit about, like, how long did that whole process take? Because I think the other thing people think is, like, I can have an idea, I can get some money together, and I can get a business within pretty short amount of time. How long was the process between I'm going to drive and learn the grossest, yuckiest jobs in fish farming, to all the conversations with all the guys, to being able to put your business plan together and win over your parents' support, and then win over support of people who were probably connected to your parents in some way before you finally broke ground on your idea? Like, what was the period of time where all of that was happening?
Oh, wow. That probably took, for me, that took a little over a year to do that. And, you know, especially for someone that hadn't previously been an entrepreneur. You know, I think folks that, you know, have done it before, it probably shortened that timeline considerably, you know, and it really comes down to identifying what are your resources, what are your challenges that you're going to have, and can you mitigate those challenges before they ever come, you know, come up. And so I think that's what I spend a lot of time on now when I consider new opportunities. Is what's it going to take? What challenges and or risks are there? And can we mitigate those risks, come out with a minimum viable product that people want? Start with the market. Is there a market for whatever it is you want to sell? There's a lot of people that think, hey, I could grow this product, Well, yeah, you sure you could, but does anybody want it? And, you know, I my brother's an engineer. I rip on him quite a bit because he's, you know, he thinks of like, oh, hey, I could build this really, really excellent thing, or this really, really excellent, you know, software. And I just look at him and I say, who cares? Is someone going to pay money for that? Just because you can do it doesn't mean that someone's going to pay money for it. And so, you know, always starting with, is there a market for it? Oh yeah, there is. Okay. Can then walk back to, can I produce it? And so I think that's a looked thing that a lot of people don't consider. Start with your market and then work backwards.
Yeah. What has been the thing that surprised you the most as you've been on this journey? What was the, like, the biggest aha or the biggest surprise?
I've had the fortunate experience of being able to hear and listen to quite a few successful entrepreneurs and hear them speak and speak about their journey and being open and honest. And every one of them said, you know, there's a lot of challenges you're going to work through. In fact, I was watching Shark Tank one night, and one of the sharks said, you know, if I would have known how much work it was, I don't know if I would have done it. As a young person, you always think, oh, well, I'm, you know, well-resourced, you know, I'm smart enough, or what, you know, you think you're on top of the world as a 22-year-old, right? And then, how's the saying go from Mike Tyson? You know, you can go into it with a perfect plan until you get punched in the face. And so just connecting with reality when it comes to, yeah, you know what, being an entrepreneur, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of sacrifice time. But a lot of people that do it and are successful at it, they would rather work an 80-hour work week for half as much money and be captains of their own fate than work 40 hours for twice as much money while working for somebody else. And so, you know, that's one of the big realities is that, yeah, it's a ton of work, but good Lord, is it rewarding?
Yeah, that's awesome. What has been maybe the thing that you were the most fearful about at 22, you know, I mean, I remember being 22. I wasn't scared of very much, you know, everything was going to work out just fine at 22. But what was the thing that perhaps you were the most fearful of, and did that fear ultimately become a reality in any way?
Yeah, I guess the only thing I should have probably has been more fearful. I don't know. You know, I guess I'm of the opinion, Rena, that when they're smart and hardworking people that decide they're going to do something and they just throw themselves at it, you don't have to have everything figured out, because honestly, no matter how much you think you got figured out, you don't. You just don't. Doesn't matter how smart you are. Doesn't matter how much money you have. If you're going to get into something, you don't know it all. And that's the sheer truth. Mm-hmm. And of course, so and so in my opinion, when you've got smart and hardworking people, you don't have to know everything going in. But you have to come into it with the attitude of, I'm not going to get it right to start, but we're going to work towards it until it is. And so as long as you've got the, you know, make sure you've got the resources that you can weather a little bit of a storm, and you go into it with the right attitude that you don't have it right for at first, but you can and will get it right, and you're going to continue to work over your long career to get it right, you know, there's... then those are the people that are successful, people that just don't quit. And those are the people that are going to make it.
That's awesome. So if listeners want to connect with you or follow you, since they can't see the video with all your great contact information right behind you there, would you mind just kind of saying how do people get a hold of you and start following Eagles Catch?
Yeah, so feel free to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and then also you can see our website at www.eagles, which is plural, -catch, like you catch a ball, .com. And you can find our website online. And then also, you know, feel free to reach out to me. There's a form there on the website to contact us. You can also feel free to reach out to us via Joe, and that's J-O-E, at eagles-catch.com.
Awesome. And for everybody who's listening, if you just happen to be driving, don't worry, just click on the show thumbnail. That's going to open up the show notes for you, and we'll have all of Joe's contact information, all of the social media handles, the website, everything will be right there for you so that you can start following Joe and his amazing organization, because I have no doubt that we are going to see a lot more fish produced in Iowa in the coming days and years. So it's going to be really exciting to see what happens to this organization. So Joe, thank you so very much again for taking time out of your day, and we just wish you nothing but the best.
Thanks, Rena.
You bet.
This is Rena Strigel, and you have been listening to Ag Inspo, the podcast. Please visit my website at tomorrowiscoming.com and find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. If you haven't yet, please go to iTunes and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week for another inspirational episode where you will hear from another amazing entrepreneur who has had the courage to break through and bring an idea to life.